Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Best Ever You Show with your host, Elizabeth Hamilton Garino, CEO and founder of the Best Ever You Network, helping you live your life to the fullest. How? Real people, including celebrities, real advice, real places, products, and businesses, real life stories. It's all right here for you with this radio show, printed magazine, websites, community, and more. Remember to visit us online, too, at besteveryou.com. And now here's your host, CEO and founder of the Best Ever You Network, Elizabeth Hamilton Garino.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Happy Thursday and happy fall. Boy, is it cold here in Maine today. We are going to have a frost warning tonight. Christine, can you believe that? I'm going to chat with you.
I don't want to tell you that it's sunny and 85 here in Charleston. Maybe you don't want to hear that.
No. Yeah, I do, actually. It sounds beautiful. Well, that was Christine Nolfi, our guest, who is a brilliant author, and we're going to talk with her in just a minute. But I want to just take care of a few things first and let you know that on Monday, October 1st, actress Joan Steiger is going to be with us. That's going to be a cool show. So, Christine, you'll have to tune in for that, too, because she's a pretty neat lady.
I will.
So that's Monday, and it's actually we usually do our shows on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but we're going to do one on Monday, and we're going to do it at noon Eastern time. So actress Joan Steiger is going to be joining us. We're very excited about that. And I also want to, and I know you do too, Christine, thank everyone at Blog Talk Radio today for featuring us under Staff Picks today. Very, very excited for you, Christine.
A lot I know. Of people thank you. And that. Thank you, Blog Talk Radio. That's a nice... I couldn't believe it when I found that out.
Yeah, I was really excited, too, and they've got your book cover there and everything. So very excited, and thank you to everyone at Blog Talk Radio for featuring our shows this week. We just really appreciate everything you do. Blog Talk Radio is such a great supporter, Christine, of everybody who's trying to do their thing independently and everything. So I love it when they take independent authors and really boost them up and propel them forward. So that's a neat thing that they did today. So thank you, Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you, Blog Talk Radio.
And I would also want to mention that we're almost approaching 600 members at the Best Ever You Network. We're getting there. Our goal is to have 1,212 members by 12/12. Got that?
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, so tell your friends and everybody to join Best Ever You. We would love to have you in there, and we love we love information that helps people be their best, and we also love those stories of people who are just doing amazing things, and you know, it doesn't have to be that amazing, you know, just something cool to share with somebody who you think, you know, if you can help make somebody's life better and you've got some advice or tips or anything like that, join us at besteveryou.com because we love our members there. So, Christine Nolfi, welcome to our show today.
Thank you for having me today, Elizabeth.
Yeah, I am.
I'm so delighted to be here.
Yeah, you're an author of, I know two books for sure, a third one in the works. I'm sure you've written many more things than that, but you're a mom of four kids and you owned a PR firm before that. So where do you want to go first?
Well, I don't know, maybe chronologically. I worked in a small public relations firm that I owned in Cleveland, Ohio for many years, which, by the way, if you're an aspiring novelist listening to this, journalism is a great preparation for writing fiction. You learn how to write on deadline. You learn how to be succinct, how to edit, how to take advice and criticism, which is, you know, is difficult for many writers. Mm-hmm. And I did that until my late 30s, and then I missed a deadline for a manufacturer in Cleveland, and I was horrified because he had to have the press release, and I had never missed a deadline. I rushed it over to his house, and his wife opened the door, and her seven Filipino kids were standing there with her. And so it was one of those divine intervention moments where my ex-husband and I had been trying to adopt. And I just happened to miss this deadline and happened to meet this woman. And 1 year later, we had adopted our four kids from the Philippines.
Aww.
At that point, I closed down the public relations firm, obviously raising four kids at once. It was a bit of a chore and fun.
Yeah, well, I'm a mom of four kids myself, so I get it completely. How old are your kids?
Three are now in college, and the baby is a high school senior.
Oh, neat.
But at the time of the adoption, they were three, four, five, and seven, but they seemed much younger because they were malnourished and they had experienced a lot of difficulties. They were living in a shelter, and but the years, once they caught up health-wise, you know, we lived at the Cleveland Clinic for, oh gosh, it seems like 5 years. But then at a certain point, they caught up, and they're doing amazingly well now.
Oh, that's so good to hear.
You know, yeah, they're great.
I was telling you before we went on air that my co-host, Dr. Katie Eastman, has an adopted daughter from China. Her name's Callie. How difficult is that to? I know she went through craziness to, you know, adopt a child from China. What do you have to go through to adopt a child or children from the Philippines?
Well, you have to have a case study done in your area. You have to find a local social worker. There's more of do-it-yourself involved in it. If you adopt a child in your state, it's much simpler. You can go through the Jobs and Family Network in your county. If you decide to go overseas, you have to still get the home study done locally. But then there are all these steps where you have to work internationally. You have to be checked by the other government. At one point, they wanted to know why we wanted 4 kids. They thought I wanted workers for my 12-acre farm, which, you know, is the kind of question you don't think about in America. But I had to have an answer for that so that they didn't think I was looking for little workers for my farm.
Yeah. I can see their viewpoint. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can understand from a developing country why they would ask that question, but as an American, it never would have occurred to me.
Yeah, I get what you're saying exactly. Yeah, I never would have thought that either. It's like, what?
Yeah. It's not the kind of question you expect.
It's kind of one of those you answer like, yeah, no.
Right. No, I'm actually, I just want to be a mommy. I don't need workers on the farm.
So do you mind if we pry for those Best Ever You listeners who are trying to have children and things like that about what you went through there as well?
Oh, no, not at all.
So many people try to have children and they're so frustrated and they can't get pregnant and all this stuff. So if you don't mind talking
about that. No, not at all.
You. Okay.
Oh, do you want me to?
Yeah, you go for it.
Well, if you do consider adoption, it seems a little cold-blooded, but you have to ask yourself, can you adopt an older child? Are you willing to adopt a child over the age of 2 that may have emotional or physical difficulties, or do you really need to adopt a baby? And there's nothing wrong with whatever your answer is. It's your comfort level as a parent. In my situation, I came from a large family. I was used to taking care of kids. I really wanted to adopt children that might not find a home because they were a large sibling group. So I was very driven to do that, partly because of my faith and definitely because of my background. I have 5 siblings. So it worked with my comfort level and my ex-husband's. He also came from a large family. But if you're considering adoption, you have to first do a check with yourself on what are you really comfortable with. And if it seems that adopting a baby is the way you should go, then by all means do that. If you would consider adopting a sibling group, I would strongly urge you to have some training in dealing with abuse and neglect, which we did twice. We went through 2 different courseworks in Ohio over 3 years to make sure that we understood what we were dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to know what you're able to do as a parent before you move forward with adoption.
And then what I was asking before is, like, what kind of process did you go through prior to that to determine, okay, you know, if I'm going to have children, what I need to do is adopt?
Well, you know, I'm a novelist, so I read everything. I spent several years reading about adoption, and really my ex-husband and I spent a lot of time talking about what were we comfortable with. And then we went ahead and had the local home study done. And we tried locally for a while to adopt, but the area of Ohio where we live, there weren't as many children up for adoption. So then we stumbled into the international adoption after that. And then the process was you have to find an agency. We went through WACAP, which I believe is in Seattle. So if you decide to go internationally, you have to work with an international agency, and then they take you through each step of the process. You probably will have to travel to a foreign country, so you have to also be comfortable with that, which I was happy to do.
Cool.
I wanted to know where my children had come from. I wanted to experience it, and we're hoping at some point as a family to go back.
Yeah, I know Katie did that. They went to China, and I think she just as soon sort of forget the living conditions that her daughter was in.
I know. And my children, it was the same situation, but I think because they were a little older, And my oldest daughter, especially, Christian's about to graduate from college, they have a lot of memories. So it's a little different than if you adopt a baby. That child, their only memory is you, but my kids have memories of their other life. And I want them to feel that they can explore that at any time they want to, or if they mm-hmm. don't, they don't have to. So we've talked about at some point, if they want to, we will go back.
Yeah, it's interesting. And do they, what are they all doing? I'm curious. And we'll go on to the novels here in a minute, too. I'm just interested in this. And I know our Best Ever You audience loves this type of thing because I know we have a lot of people with adopted children or wanting to adopt. What are they all doing now? I know you said they're in college. What are they studying? Are they good students? You know,
they're all wonderful students. My son has had more trouble deciding what he wants to do, but he fell into hospitality management, and he's one of these really gregarious kids who should work in the resort industry. He makes everybody happy when they're around him. So just this year he discovered, wow, I love this, after stumbling through a couple different majors and not knowing what he wanted to do. Christian, my oldest, she's always talked about she would like to do something in diplomacy or something to help NGOs internationally.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if at some point she'll decide maybe she needs a law degree. She's about to graduate from her undergraduate, and she's an adult now. I don't want to influence her too much. I just want to encourage whatever she chooses. The other daughter, Marley, that's in college, I'm not sure. I think she's leaning toward communications or public relations. She's a real happy-go-lucky kid, and everybody that meets her falls in love with her.
Aww.
So she'll definitely do something, I think, PR-related, like Mom.
Yeah,
you know, or,
yeah,
that, that would be my guess.
And then
the baby, she's more artistic. I think Marguerite will find something in art to do.
So three girls and a boy.
Yeah, three girls and a boy.
Three girls and a boy.
Yeah,
wow.
And Elizabeth, the teenage years were fun.
Taking all those
girls through the teen years.
Oh, my gosh. I can't even imagine paying for college. Oh, my gosh.
Well, they're all right in a row in school. So every phase that we went through, it was a little bit easier because it was, you know, the junior high phase and the high school phase, and now it's the college phase.
You know what? That's what we've got here, too, because the kids are basically all teenagers. So they're like 11, 13, 15, and 17. So it's actually kind of getting easier. They go through all their phases together, yeah.
Yes,
sure.
Right, exactly. So
Although people look at you and go,
wow, but it's easier because of that.
It'll be us parents living in the tent while the kids are at college, though.
Yes, those college loans.
Where are mom and dad?
They're living in a tent.
They are. They're walking. That's funny. All right, so you've done all these wonderful things, and then one day you said, okay, I'm going to write books. How'd that go? How did you transition, or where did this all come from?
Well, at first, I had been trying to write fiction all through my 30s, but you know, deadline to deadline, and you're working full time and you own your own business, there just wasn't time. I kept making the attempt, and then in my 40s, when my marriage started to fall apart, I had one of those do or die moments. Where I wanted to take all the sorrow that I felt and I wanted to turn it into beauty. And I thought, I've always wanted to write fiction. This is the time to start. And so I sat down in the worst time of my life and started to work. And I look back on that now and I think, you know, and you've been through this, Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
We've all gone through major crises. Nobody gets through life without them. And I think what we sometimes fail to recognize is during those moments of our lives that seem the darkest, there may actually be the most light. It might be the universe telling you, look at this, do this. Now is the time for you to step forward in this direction.
Yeah, there pain and crisis and things like that. They always seem to be learning opportunities, and it's very interesting how the coolest things sometimes come around and about from something just kind of dreadful, awful, or minor crisis. Just, you know, something. It seems like a lot of people bring, like, just exactly what you're saying, bring their light in right there.
Right.
And
I think we all are able to do that. It's a choice. We have to choose to look at the situation and say, yes, this is a crisis. I'm in pain. How do I want to respond to this? Do I want to open the door and let in light, or do I want to stand here in the dark? Yeah. And we all encounter that.
Yeah, we do. So what was the first book that you wrote?
Well, actually, the book that I'm releasing in October is the first book I wrote, Second Chance Grill. Random House really enjoyed it. I'm not sure why it never sold. Publishing is a mystery. And then the second book I wrote was The Tree of Everlasting Knowledge, the book that was released last March. Treasure Me, which was my first release, is actually the third book I wrote. But I felt it gave the best background on the characters in the Liberty series that I would continue to use. So I wanted that book to come out first.
And what? Okay, so I've never interviewed somebody who's written three books or four books. Or it's three. Is it three or four?
It's three books.
Just
the books are in a series. Treasure Me and Second Chance Grill are books in the Liberty series.
Yeah.
They're contemporary fiction that blend mystery and romance. They're a little suspenseful in parts. They're lighter, like the movie Steel Magnolias.
Mm-hmm.
Tree of Everlasting Knowledge is a darker, closer to literary book. I think that draws more on my experiences as a parent and some of the things you go through with adoption. I was definitely dealing with the grief of my divorce as I wrote it. So it's a darker book, more suspenseful.
Okay. But in order, like if someone were to go out and buy these books, in order it goes Treasure, which way does it go?
Treasure Me.
Treasure Me, and, second.
Yes,
second
and then the next book in that series is coming out in October. That's entitled Second Chance Grill.
Second Chance Grill, yeah.
And The Tree of Everlasting Knowledge is a standalone novel. I'm working on a series, but I also want to continue writing standalone books.
Yeah, that's neat. And of the three books, which one's your favorite?
You know, everybody asks that question. I love the humor and the bonding between the women that carry the Liberty series, and I love that about Treasure Me and Second Chance Grill. But Tree is closer to my heart because it does talk about abuse and adoption and what it's like to be a foster parent. So I think that's probably the book closest to my heart.
Mm-hmm. And how can people can go to your website, which I'm going to spell. It's CHRISTINENOLFI.com, so they can see your books and everything about you there. But also, Treasure Me and Second Chance Grill are on Amazon. Is that correct?
I'm sorry. It's Treasure Me and The Tree of Everlasting Knowledge.
I'm sorry. You just go to Amazon and Google her name. You'll find all of her
Google
books.
Google my name. You'll
Christine
see.
Alfie, you'll see her. Because I'm not getting this all straight.
Second Chance Grill will be on Amazon in a couple of weeks.
Well,
it's
I think it's really cool because it's like, here are my three books. Here's what I've done. And, here
coming.
I am. It's like, talk about making a huge statement of, book writing. It's pretty neat. To get people interested in the books, for example, what's Treasure Me about?
Treasure Me is about a beautiful thief who arrives in a small town of Liberty, Ohio, and she's searching for a treasure that's been hidden since the Civil War. The treasure she finds has nothing to do with avarice, and it has to do with cultivating self-love and the discovery of what it means to be part of a family. USA Today called the book one of the best of the indies, which that was quite a thrill. I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah.
And the Midwest Book Review recommends it as a riveting read for those who enjoy adventure fiction.
Oh, I love that.
Is
it your PR background that gets the books out there?
Yes, absolutely.
I wrote,
it's all over Twitter today. If you want to go on my Twitter feed and look at the How to Get Your Books Reviewed, that's definitely drawn from my PR background. And I worked with two literary agents before deciding to go indie. And the whole idea of you have to query, you have to know how to approach a reviewer, it's a critical part of writing fiction. Because how is anyone to know if your work is worth reading if you don't have reviews that are qualified reviews?
Well, it's a good point.
It's something I talk about with other writers all the time.
Yeah.
Because, they're a little lost. How do you go about doing that? And so I've written posts on it, so they can go onto my website, read the posts. Molly Green is a wonderful author. She's running the How to Get Your Books Review post on her blog this week, I believe.
Yeah, I'd like
so
to read
that. So they can
go
there, too.
Yeah. Now, does that post and information apply to all types of authors or just fiction?
All types of authors.
Okay.
How you need to go about in the internet age, getting those reviews. And, you know, it's a tedious process, Elizabeth, but anybody can do it.
It's
not
very
difficult.
It's very. And how did you just for people listening, I know there's a lot of authors listening and so forth, and everybody knows what this means, but for somebody listening who's not an author, indie means you've published the book by yourself, you've gone on to something like CreateSpace or Lulu.com or, you know, Author House or whatever, and you've put the book out there yourself.
That's
and then
correct.
You're promoting it with maybe a little help from them, but pretty much you're on your own, and it either goes or doesn't.
That's
the book
correct.
Either takes off or not. As opposed to like a traditional publisher where you have an agent, they sell the book, and, you know, Random House picks it up, and voila, you know, there you are in every, you know, bookstore across America, which is pretty much kind of almost, is that almost unheard of these days to get those types of deals?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
To get a traditional publishing deal, is that pretty tough these days?
You know, I think it's easier if you are in a specific genre. If you think about what a traditional publisher needs, they want to buy a book and they want to place it in a bookstore. And if you as a reader walk into that bookstore, you know what you like to read. You like to read literary or suspense or romance. Whatever it is you like to read, you know where to go in the store to find that. If you're a writer of the stripe that I am, where you mix genres, it's harder for a traditional publisher to know where to put your book.
Mm-hmm.
Do I fit in literary fiction or women's fiction, or should they put me in with cozy mysteries or with romance? So that was my problem, and I suspect that a lot of indie writers encounter the same problem. Now, if you're a writer who can fit a genre, if you're writing straight romance or straight mystery, by all means, you should try traditional publishing first. See if you can secure representation with an agent. See if you can find an editor that's interested. But if you're someone who is mixing genres, the physical bookshelf may not be the right place for you. With independent publishing and the advent of e-readers, it's easy for people to blend genres, and if they write well, they'll have the reviews that'll back that up, and readers will download. And then from there, you'll start to sell paperback versions of your book. But somebody with an e-reader, they don't really care about where you would fit in a bookstore. They want to know how well you've been reviewed, and do you have good reviews?
Yeah.
So it's made a huge difference in publishing.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear. And what happens if you've got a bad one up there? What happens if you've got a bad review? Or, you know, does that kill you? Are you dead in the water with a bad review?
Well, if you're a debut novelist, not just novelist, if you're any writer who's put out a book, if you put out nonfiction, and you've independently published and you notice that your reviews tend to be 1 or 2 star and you're not receiving 4 or 5 star reviews, I think you need to stop and ask yourself if the book was ready. Did you hire an editor? Did you have a graphic designer design the cover? Or did you put this out too quickly? Did you have beta readers read the book and give an opinion? So I think that if qualified reviewers are telling you this book is not good enough, I think you need to go back and give it some more work. I would take it down from Amazon myself and see if you're just jumping too soon.
Yeah. That's a good thought. Yeah, you know, I've got a children's book out there called Pinky Doodlebug.
Oh, I love that title.
It's out there, and it's got I agree with you completely. That one is independent. I published that one independently, and it sold quite a few copies, but I totally agree with you with the 4 and 5 star ratings needing to be there more than the ones. I mean, I think I've gotten a few ones where people are like, oh, the book wasn't as long as I thought it was or something like that, just some funny comments, but nothing like, you know, this book sucks or, you know, or anything like that.
You know, I received my first 1 star review for Treasure Me just a couple weeks ago, and I thought, well, you know, everybody gets this. I was going to have a low review at some point. And I went in and read what the reader said. And Amazon, because so many of my reviews say that the work is inspiring, so Amazon put the book on an inspiration list. And the reader was not happy that I used expletives. I use them sparingly. But she obviously was a devout Christian, and she wasn't happy to see that on an inspiration list. So as far as I was concerned, she had every right to give
review, though. Yeah,
But what she was saying was, this is not what I would read. Why is this on an inspiration list? Well, to Amazon, it was on an inspiration list because so many readers said the book was inspiring.
Inspiration.
Yeah, and what are you going to do about that? That's valid.
Yeah, you know, and you can't please everybody either, so, you know.
No, you can't.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so go to Second Chance Grill then for me and tell us what that one's about.
Second Chance Grill, it's the second book in the Liberty series, and each of the books bring new characters into this small town. In Treasure Me, I don't want to give the book away, but the two main characters will bring a newspaper to the town. And in Second Chance Grill, it's a doctor who arrives thinking she's only staying for a short while, and she meets a precocious 11-year-old named Blossom Perini, who's struggling with health issues. And the book is about their relationship as much as it is about the doctor falling in love with Blossom's father. Again,
okay.
I don't want to give spoilers.
But in 1,000,000,000 years, I would never, ever think of that or those names or anything. How do you come up with this? Where does this come from?
You know, Elizabeth, I've been writing my entire life. I'm worried that I won't live long enough to write all of the books I want to write. As far as I'm concerned, somebody just give me a guarantee to age 85 so I can at least write 30 books. Honestly, the ideas just arrive.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I feel that way about writing children's books. If somebody could just give me an illustrator 24/7 to get
all the
ideas out, you know, I'd be great.
How many books could you produce?
Oh,
kids, dinner's a little late tonight.
I love writing kids' books. But, you know, it takes forever to illustrate them, and it's so expensive as well.
I know.
So it's amazing. But, you know, for somebody thinking about writing a book, I know there are a lot of people who, you know, it's their dream to just write one. You know, I just want to write a book. I just want to publish a book. I just want to be published. You know, I'm sure you hear that.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Hasn't the internet made that lovely to be able to do?
Oh, absolutely. If you want to put something out there, you're capable of doing it. I think if you want to write, you have to ask yourself, do I want to produce one book? Or do I want a career as a writer? And, you know, different people have different answers to that. And then once you know what your answer is, then if you want to publish one book, spend your time working on that one book. Let all of your friends know about it and see what happens. But if you write something and you're thinking, this is all I want to write, if it takes off and readers love it, they'll be emailing asking you, where's the next book? So you may put yourself on a journey that you weren't expecting to be on.
Isn't that interesting too? Is that you? Are you on a journey that you didn't know you were going to be on exactly?
Elizabeth, I always hoped that this would be my journey. I never dreamed I would do it the way that it came about, going through divorce, the tumult that my children and I and my ex-husband underwent. I never thought it would occur in this fashion. So, yes, I'm on the journey I always expected, but did I expect the road to be that rocky? No, not in a million years. But doesn't everybody say that? You know, you had health issues that you had to deal with. Your family has. Looking back, you might think, I never expected that.
Well, yeah, it's definitely one of those things. And everybody kind of says that. It's a real common thing that a mentor will say to you. For example, one of my mentors is Fred Cuellar from Diamond Cutters International, and he'll say, okay, that's your goal. And when you get to that goal, you will look back and go, wow, what a journey I went on to get there. That's nothing that I ever expected.
Exactly.
Yeah, and just absolutely wild. Some of the things that you just are like, okay. And what I think is interesting is how one thing, it all connects. It's kind of all serendipity, a little divine intervention, there's a lot of different things that happen in your life.
I think we have to pay attention to the synchronicity in our lives. I'm amazed at, meeting you. You know, we started chatting on Twitter, and Fred, I love Fred. I think he is so inspiring.
Isn't he fun? Yeah.
He is. He's a blast, and he just puts out such a positive vibe on the internet. I love it. But you have to pay attention in your life to the synchronicity, to the people you bump into, to the ideas that suddenly seem compelling that you want to follow. I think we all have opportunities for wonder every single day, and we have to be open to it, and we have to pay attention to whatever it is that the universe is trying to show us.
Very much so. It's very living, very aware, and living consciously, and living, you know, just really living and paying attention, and especially paying attention to the quiet too. What do you think about, as far as quiet goes, what do you think about your gut instinct?
I have a little trick with myself, Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. If I've been working so hard that I can't sense space between my thoughts, I know it's time to unplug. If I don't sense that, and it's one thought after another, you know, in yoga they talk about the chattering monkey in your head.
You know what I'm talking about. With the clangy noise, too. Or...
Right. Yes, exactly. And anyone who parents children, you know, you have that those days that are chattering monkey days. If I can't sense space between my thoughts, I know it's absolutely time to unplug. And I go and I work out, or I swim laps, or I practice yoga. I do something physical to give my brain a break. Yeah. And I think we forget that we have to have the balance between what our mind wants to achieve and what our bodies need.
Yes, I want to reiterate that so much, especially to people who are creative, because creative people tend to get on a roll, and to get the creativity out, I don't know about you, but I'll go for like 4 days straight. And, you know, I don't mean without sleeping or anything like that or anything unhealthy, but I mean, I'll get up the next morning at 5 a.m. and write, you know, until 2
exactly.
or something. But, you know when the creativity is flowing, but you also know when you're done, and then take a break.
Well, I think the trick, Elizabeth, is a lot of people aren't aware when they're done. One of the things that always bothered me about, I'm not picking on writers because I'm one, but it bothers me anytime I've gone to a writer's conference and so many of the other authors are overweight, they look exhausted. Not that I haven't been there too. I have days like that. But you have to honor your body, because it carries you and allows you to create whatever it is that you create. And it's okay to go through those phases of, like you say, 4 days of I'm on fire, the words are flowing, that's great. But then you have to balance that with time to nurture your body and honor it and give your body what it needs.
Yeah, I completely check out for 3 days at a time. Sometimes, like this past summer, I checked out for a whole month. I'm like, I am just hardly going on that computer.
Yeah,
I do things like that. I didn't do any radio shows. I didn't do anything, and I just hung out with the kids and just chilled out. It's like, okay,
I think
a little bit of a break.
I think one of the best parts about parenting is because kids force you to go to soccer practice or you join
yeah.
Girl Scouts with them. You do a lot of things that connect you back to the natural world. And, you know, once we're past the child-rearing years, it's very easy to just slip into our professional molds and lose that connection with the natural world. If you never walk in a park or in a forest and experience that sort of silence, you're definitely out of balance for anybody.
Yeah, I love to go out with my camera. Are you a picture taker by any chance? I love.
No, and I would love to learn. Teach me, Elizabeth.
You know what? I don't even know. I just got myself a better, like a camera in between one of the fancy schmancy ones and the pocket ones, just somewhere there in between with kind of a good zoom. And I don't even care what people think.
I think it's a good picture.
Yeah, but I go out and I'll take pictures of flowers or trees or birds or something like that. And if it comes out relatively in focus, it's a good picture.
But isn't it wonderful how that keeps you in the present moment where you can feel gratitude and appreciate the flower or whatever it is that you're photographing?
Yeah, it's so much fun. And with anything you don't have a clue about and you just start doing, you get better. You learn.
Oh, absolutely.
Is that the
and that lets the child out inside of you because
oh, yeah.
we stumble through it and we discover things, and that's part of the fun of life.
Yeah. Do you think
I would want to know everything?
Do you think that's true with writing?
Oh, absolutely. If you don't stumble through some things, and one of the tricks that I did a lot when I was younger and desperately wanted to write fiction, it was trying to figure out how do you write long fiction. I had a short story published in Working Mother magazine when I was young. But there's a difference between short story and a long work. I used to read books whatever it was that struck me, and if I read a paragraph that I felt had really moved me emotionally, I would hand write out that paragraph because I wanted to get a feel of the flow that the writer had used and why was it so impactful. And it seems silly now, but I think in the same way that a child will write a word over and over again if they're learning vocab for fifth grade English, I think that was one of the training tools for learning how to write fiction or Shakespeare. Take any of Shakespeare's sonnets and just hand write it out. And you get a sense of the work in a way you don't if you just read it.
That's really cool advice. Yeah, that's.
It sounds strange, but it really opened me up.
Well, I'm thinking to my fifth grader. I've got a fifth grade boy, and he's writing out words, writing out sentences. And
why don't we use the same tools that we teach our children to use? What's wrong with it? Opens up parts of us that we tend to shut down as we get older.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm curious if how you're doing with, speaking of kids, because mine are constantly on iPads, iTouches, Kindle, Xbox, everything known to mankind. Do you think that, for example, my kids don't emerge from the restroom with a newspaper, they emerge from the restroom with an iPad? Do you think books are going to go to the wayside and all of these devices are going to be where it's at?
I think a lot of people will transfer all of their reading to an electronic. I mean, think about if you're a kid in school and all those books you have to lug around. I can see why college campuses would want everybody equipped with an iPad because they could put the textbooks in the iPad. But physical books, there's a tactile pleasure to holding a book, smelling it, turning the pages. I don't think books will ever disappear. I hope not.
I hope not.
I love my iPad, but I also love to pick up a physical book. Don't you love to go in a library and pull down a book and just discover something new?
Yeah, I love books. We just went to Books a Million and bought six books the other day. So we're doing our part to help. Yeah, I mean, I just love real books, so I hope it doesn't ever go away.
No, I can't imagine that they ever will. But I think what's actually happening is e-reading is opening up more people to reading. I think there's a whole segment of society that may never have picked up a book if they didn't have their device and they learn about, all these books on Amazon and you can download this or that. I think it's actually expanding reading.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm an optimist.
Yeah, I don't know. I agree with you that it's expanding reading. I don't know if it's expanding print is what I'm trying to say. I'm not sure it's expanding print, but who knows.
Yeah,
but I definitely
I
agree with you
out.
That it's, I think it is too. It's a phase and it'll come back. But I agree with you that it's totally expanding reading. I was on in the airport and I'm sort of newer to the iPad. I've got one. I've had it for about almost a year now. So I'm not one of the ones rushing out to get your new iPhone 5 or anything like that. I'm pretty mellow. And I started downloading books to the iPad finally because I had time more than anything. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, because it's easier for me to pick up a book and just read it as opposed to downloading, and all this stuff and sitting there with my iPad making sure it's charged and all that stuff. But I have books on there. Some of the books you can even get for free.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's so cool.
Yeah, and it's a good way to learn about a new writer. A couple great writers this week, I believe Rob Guthrie is running a free book. He's a wonderful writer, and I think Rachel Thompson is, and Frederick Brooke. They're all indie writers. You can go on Amazon and just type their names in and see if they have a free book this week. Download it, see if you like their writing.
Tell me those names one more time. Can you remember?
Frederick Brooke. His last name is Brooke. His book is entitled Doing Max Final. I believe that may be free this week. Rob Guthrie, his last name is Guthrie. I'm not sure if it's Bloodland that's free this week, but I believe one of his books is.
Cool.
And Rachel Thompson, she writes scathingly funny satire. Her book, I believe, Man Code Exposed, I believe that is free this week. And it's a great way to find, I'm sorry.
Man Code Exposed, is that what you said?
Yeah, Man Code Exposed. if you like satire, if you want something funny.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, it's a great way to discover new talent is to check the free list and see what's there.
Yeah. So what do you think, if there's people out there listening right now to you and they want to write, what advice do you have for them?
If you're serious about writing, the first thing you should do is join a critique group. You have to be in your own tribe. You have to learn from other writers, and you need to learn how to receive constructive criticism. I'm still a member of Romance Writers of America as an associate member because I'm not strictly a romance writer. But they have great groups across the country. You can get critique partners. Another one, Mystery Writers of America. It's worth it to join some of these groups, even if you're writing nonfiction, because you can hook up with qualified critique partners. So that would be the first thing I would suggest that someone do. The second thing is start using social media to see what is being said about publishing. There's a wealth of information now that you couldn't have accessed even 3 years ago. Molly Green talks about independent publishing. Her last name is G-R-E-E-N-E. Her blog is a must-read for anyone thinking about writing. She discusses a lot of the different aspects of publishing. But if you just go on the Internet, it's very easy now to learn about publishing and the steps that you need to take.
And earlier you said stick to a specific genre if you want to see your book, maybe in a bookstore, for example.
If you want to approach a publisher in New York or London, you have a higher chance of selling your work, you know, finding an agent and having the agent sell the work if you do write within a genre so that they can see where they would place your book in a bookstore.
Yeah. And, you know, let me back that thought up for 1 second. If you independent publish, can your book ever make it to the bookstore?
Oh, absolutely. Barnes & Noble has a new program where they're working with indie publishers. I'm getting ready to check it out. You know, there's criteria. You have to be you have to have a lot of high reviews. It helps to have a Kirkus review, which I'm getting ready to do for my books.
What did you just say? A what review?
A Kirkus review. It's a review site that traditional publishing uses. If they give you a good review, there's a better chance that bookstores will pick up your novel or your nonfiction book. Another site, I used Midwest Book Review. They gave Treasure Me a very high rating, and the book is starting to be picked up by libraries because of that.
So even if you
want to independently publish, the industry is changing so much, Elizabeth, that the line is blurring between what's published in New York or London and what is independently published. Mm. Actually, the best indie published novelists last year, all 10 of the top sellers signed traditional contracts after they became bestsellers. So that's blurring the line even more.
Yeah.
Somebody may start out independent and end up with a traditional contract.
Huh. Yeah, that's really exciting to hear as well. And what do you think makes a top-selling book? Is it really a million copies, or is it in the, you know,
bestseller really has more to do with velocity than volume. So it's not so much the number of books that's sold, it's how quickly are those books selling. So it's more about velocity. If you're to become an Amazon bestseller, if you're suddenly getting a lot of downloads, you know, you think of it as an airplane that's suddenly zooming quickly. That's what a bestseller is.
Hmm.
And but you know, the bestseller tag isn't always a great tag. There are some books that slowly build and they become classics. So
yeah.
Did they ever become a bestseller? Did they ever have the velocity in 1 month to hit that list? No, maybe not, but they may be a classic.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I'd get too hung up on bestseller.
No, yeah. I think I'd get more hung up on, I actually did this and completed it, and it's out there.
What matters to me is receiving email from readers who stumble across one of my books, and it increases now. I have more and more of that mail coming in, and they say, I just loved Treasure Me or Tree, and I'm going to pick up the other book now. And to me, that you know, that's why I write. I want someone to be moved by what was written. I want to change their world in some way. I want to open them up to different ideas. And I think that's what all writers want.
I totally agree with you, and people are tweeting us, both you and me, you and I, Which one is it? Both you and me.
Yeah.
Come on, writer.
Edit me. Comfortable.
Edit my speech.
I never do that.
I wish I could text. Well, if you just throw in texting on top of tweeting and being on the radio and a little bit of bubblegum, I'll be all set.
You know, Elizabeth, I have to tell you this. I'm joining. I probably shouldn't be saying this on the radio. A woman in Charleston has asked me to join. We're going to create a book club group in this area. But I don't want any of the people that join to know that I'm a novelist, because then they'll feel like they have to edit everything they say. And I just want to read great books and hear what readers love to read.
Yeah, I totally agree. Anybody can edit. You know what I mean? You can give anything to an editor and they'll fix it all up.
Pretty. There you go.
Hey, you know. But Deborah Oakland, she's on Twitter and in our chat room also. Hi, Deborah. How are you? She's from Laguna Beach.
Hi, Deborah.
Yes. She loved your statement there when you said, why don't we teach our kids, why don't we do what we teach our kids to do? So
absolutely.
She really liked that a lot. But Deborah, if you have any other questions, just let us know. But she's listening, and she said, great to meet you. And then she also tweeted out to Molly Green.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, Molly's here.
Hi, Molly.
Anybody who's not following Molly Green on Twitter is crazy.
Okay, let me make sure real quick that I am. Okay.
She's a wealth of information.
You know, I would add to the mix there Lisa Tenner. Lisa Tenner is do you know Lisa Tenner at all?
You know, I'm familiar with the name, but I'm not sure I've ever talked to her directly.
She's awesome, too. She's one to follow. If you're in the self-help realm of writing, Lisa Tenner is one to just completely follow as well.
Oh, I'm writing that down.
Lisatener, Lisa Tenner. So we love our Lisa Tenner on Best Ever You. She's one of our experts and so forth. But yeah, Deborah's like, hi there, following Molly and Christine now on Twitter. So that's good.
Thank you.
Okay, so, you know, let me check time here and see what we've got left as far as time goes. We've got about 15 minutes or so, a little under 15 minutes. What else should we talk about in that time frame? What do you want to talk about?
Oh, whatever you think that would help your listeners the most.
Well, I have an idea, but I just don't know if you can talk about it because the book isn't out yet.
Sure.
You said something is near and dear to your heart. That's the closest one that's near and dear to your heart. And sometimes when things are like that, they make things the best. And that's Tree of Everlasting Knowledge that you said.
That's correct.
Said that. Why? What's different about that one?
It's a closer to literary novel. Treasure Me is a great book too, but it's fun fiction. It's closer to the movie Steel Magnolias. It'll make you laugh. It'll make you cry. The Tree of Everlasting Knowledge is closer to literature. You know, how we define what becomes literary is up for grabs on any given day. But the journey that it takes the main characters on, and the way that it communicates a lot of the issues around foster parenting and adopting and the abuse that children have experienced, I'm really proud of the way I handled it. Trying to write part of the novel in the point of view of a child who had experienced abuse was incredibly difficult. It took several years. And the reviews that I receive on Tree are absolutely the highest. Treasure Me has great reviews too, but Tree, hands down, beats Treasure Me on reviews. And I think it's because a lot of people can connect to the book.
Yeah.
I think it speaks to a lot of people who have either heard about abuse, have experienced it, and it's very hopeful. It really shows that even in the darkest times, we can find our greatest light. And I think that connects with readers.
Now,
so that's why.
Oftentimes when you write a book, and probably almost all the time, I'm going to guess, there are parts of that book that are going to be drawn from you, your experiences, your life, everything, and it's going to make you so open and vulnerable. Do you disguise
that? That's exactly what. Yeah.
Or are you
exactly
an open target?
Well, but you have to. You know, I don't mind being an open target. I really, truly don't. If I can help one person to find their inner beauty. If something I write can make one reader go out and say, I can do this, or my world is beautiful, I'm happy to take as many arrows, you know.
Yeah.
go ahead. Because I believe in my work.
Yeah.
I don't need an outer verification at this point. I know it's good. But, again, I think that comes from age. I'm in my 50s now. It's a little You're a little more stable.
Yeah, no, I hear you there, but I think the other point of that I'm trying to get at, my meat and potatoes of that question, really is when you sit down to write, how easy is it to be dishonest with yourself? In other words, if you're writing about somebody who, you know, let's just say you're writing about divorce or something like that, and
okay.
you start writing about your experience and things like that or whatever, and you've disguised it under a character or another character or something like that, but people really know that that really happened to you, or they think it might happen to you or whatever. Does that make you scared when you're sitting there writing, like, oh, I better not write that?
Well, I don't tend to be terribly autobiographical in my writing. Obviously my life influences my work. But what I end up creating, you know, the main character in Tree isn't like anyone I really know. There is a scene in the novel when she takes Walt to the dentist that is absolutely out of my life. It's the most straight writing I've ever done in any of my fiction. It's an experience that happened with my son. But what happens at the end of the scene is actually something that one of my daughters said to me. Raising children of color, we have an interesting look at things, and she forgave me for not being brown. So that one scene is the most autobiographical that of anything I've ever written. But do I mind? I don't mind opening myself up because I trust the process at this point.
Yeah.
Again, I think that has to do with being a little bit older,
mm-hmm.
having
well,
more trust.
Yeah, and I'm also in that question trying to sort of help those who are starting out writing or are maybe stuck or in the middle of it or whatever. And I know a lot of people sit there and go, I better not write that. Or I wonder what people are going to think if I write that.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it's best to be writing straight from your life. When I begin any work, I always start with the what if question. You know, what if I took this situation and I added that to it? What would be the outcome? Or what if this type of a character ran into that type of a character? What would be the outcome? So I think if you're asking yourself the what-if question, which anyone writing fiction should do daily, you're not writing directly from your life. You're taking your emotional experience and you're putting that on the page, but you're putting it in a fresh way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's great, yeah. I met with Dina Tess Gerritsen. Have you ever heard of her? She's an author.
Yes.
Well, she's funny because she takes some characters from her real life and puts them in the book.
Does she really? I don't think I could do that. Well, doesn't anyone ever become angry with her?
Oh, yeah. Well, she said she altered the male slightly so that they'd never come claim them.
And then they never speak to her again. I don't know if I would want to do that.
I'm crying again. I almost cried right there laughing when she was telling me about that. I'm like, are these characters real? And she's like, oh, yeah, they are, but I've altered.
I don't think I create my fiction quite the same way.
So funny. But, you know, really interesting. What were you like as a kid? Did you write like this when you were in grade school?
Really. Yes. I think a lot of us really have to pay attention to what we do as children because, you know, the universe is telling us so much. I was the kid telling everybody goofy stories, that there was treasure hidden. I would convince the kids on the street that I could fly, and then I'd be standing in a treehouse thinking, oh, no, if I actually try, I'm going to break my legs. So, you know, yeah, my whole life I've been telling stories.
Oh,
so, you know, you come into life with certain gifts, I suppose.
Oh, and I totally agree with you there, too, to pay attention to the kid in you.
Yeah,
it's
well,
still
didn't
there.
You during
it's
childhood discover
a
lot of who Elizabeth is today?
What did you say?
Didn't you discover during your childhood a lot of who you became as
yeah.
a woman?
Oh, yeah.
When you look back?
At 43, I'm still that same tap dancing, gymnastics, writing person.
There you go.
Bigger and older. I'm the same thing, just, you know, more kids and,
and
bigger and older.
And if looked at you at 5 years old, that was exactly who you were.
Oh, yeah, totally. In fact, you know, I'm sure you have the same thing, but my Facebook is filled with people that I went to even elementary school together. And, you know, everybody from high school, elementary school, everything
right.
is in there, and they're like, oh, same person, you know. I'm like, and nobody really strays too far off who they are. I mean, you can look at everybody from high school and go, yep.
Yep, that's exactly what I expected, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Just follow that bliss.
That's funny. Now, we have a question. I know we're getting a little choppy here in the end, but it's okay. Deborah wants to know, for self-help books, do you recommend independent or traditional publishing? And I have a thought there, but I'm wondering what your thought is first.
I would try traditional first because self-help sells so well.
Yeah.
If I were writing a self-help, I would try traditional first.
Yeah.
Good chance of finding representation and a publisher.
That's my thought, too. Having just been, I'm signing with Hay House.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you, yes. Very exciting for my book, Percolate, which is self-help. But, you know, and Deborah, I would tell you that you're going to go through a bunch of no's to get to that yes. So don't you think?
But you have to be prepared for that. That's just part of the process. And a no doesn't necessarily mean your work is bad.
No.
It simply means that house is not purchasing that type of book presently. That's all it means.
Yeah. And you just go and go and go and go and go until you get the yes. And, you know, the other thing about that is I actually also wouldn't be afraid to independent publish, because if it really is a good book and good reviews and things like that, it'll sell either way. People will find you. That's one of the best pieces of advice Fred Quayer ever gave me. He said, you know, if it's good, people will find it. If it's popular, people will find it. People will seek you.
Well, and I wouldn't rule out a traditional contract at some point. I think a lot of indie published authors, if they do well and they've blended genres the way I have, they eventually go with a traditional house. But they build their readership on their own so that a traditional publisher can see, okay, this book doesn't sit in this genre or that, but clearly they have a readership, and therefore we should pick them up and promote.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Go ahead.
You can start in indie and end up a traditional. But if you're writing something like self-help, I would definitely try the traditional route first.
Yeah. And the other thing I would say, I know one thing to avoid, what I would avoid anyway, and what I turned down was a place that wanted to kind of sit in the middle of self-help and traditional publisher, meaning they were going to put the book up on their site and all this wonderful stuff, but they wanted me to purchase 20,000 books at half
cost,
kind of thing, so sit on the inventory. So then they said, okay, that's great, but at the end of the year, if nothing's sold, you know, you're writing one big fat check for all of that inventory. So I wouldn't do either.
No, I wouldn't either. I would absolutely run in the opposite direction from something
yes,
like that.
Exactly.
That should send the red flags right
the
up.
Blob. Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. So hopefully that gives you some advice there to people listening about, you know, publishing and so forth. And I think, now what would you do with children's books? Because children's books is just a crazy.
You know, honestly, because a lot of publishers don't look at children's books as something that can earn money, even though clearly they can, I think I would go independent if I were writing children's literature. Yes.
That's what I made. After that one, I got hundreds of rejections on.
It's a tough market to crack.
Yeah, and they wanted to take the script but not the illustrator, and I'm like, no, we developed these characters together, you know, kind of thing. So,
I think I would tend to build my own readership and take that independent,
which
is why I went independent, is I knew that it would be, and I knew I had a readership out there.
Yeah.
I knew absolutely I did, but, you know, some books, if it can't, and children's literature, it's just a tough nut to crack.
Yeah, I can't believe we're out of time.
I absolutely
believe we're out of time, so... we just have
Elizabeth,
a little bit of time
you.
Here.
Elizabeth, thank you. Wonderful.
Oh, I am so proud and honored to have you with us today. And I wish you all the success in the world on these books. Treasure Me, Second Chance Grill, and the Tree of Everlasting Knowledge. Good luck with everything. I'm so darn proud to have you on here. And just best of shit. Everybody in the chat room, round of applause for Christine. And
thank you, Elizabeth.
Oh, thank you for being with us. And please visit Christine. Christine, what's your Twitter?
Christine Nolfi, my name.
Okay. And
CHRISTINENOLFI.
Yep. And same thing on the website.com there on the website. So thank you for being with us. And I hope you have a beautiful 85 what degree day?
Yes, it's 85 and sunny here in South Carolina.
Enjoy. We're going to be snowing soon.
Let's stay warm.
Thank you. All right, take care, everybody, and hopefully we'll see you Monday with actress Joan Steiger at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. Have a great day, everybody. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Best Ever You Show. Want more? Visit us at besteveryou.com. Be your best and keep it real. Confident, successful, caring, and beautiful every day with Best Ever You.